And I'd like to begin just by saying, for those of you who did send financial support, thank you. I really appreciate it. It really makes this happen, so I'm very appreciative of that. Let me just take a look once again who's with us. Missed anybody? Okay. So the way I'd like to begin is I'd like to do a review of what we went over last time, and then we'll just have a brief time for Q&A, and then we're going to go into the content of what we're going to be exploring today. So first of all, a review. Will be coming to you in just a second here. Okay, a review. So hopefully you can see this on the screen right now. I want to go over what we explored last time. Also, just another caveat, if something comes up and you can't see clearly or you can't hear me, you can just type in the chat box. You might remember that we began last time with clarifying that the Buddha was not actually answering the question of if there's a self or not a self. And you might remember the story of Vajjagoda going to the Buddha and asking the Buddha if there was a self or not self and not getting an answer. And the Buddha was really clear, you know, because he thought that would have led to confusion, that this is actually not about answering that question. It's about understanding how our suffering arises and how to become free of it. That's what I put secondly. Rather, this is the exploration of how the mind gets entangled in the process of identification and we suffer from it and how it becomes free of this entanglement. And then you might remember last time I went over what we commonly identify with and then the classical teaching around that are the five khandhas that we went over. Sometimes it's easier to think about it in terms of words that we use more commonly, like how we identify with this body and how we suffer from that, because when it changes, then we suffer because it's not the way we want it to be. Or we identify with emotions, we identify with thoughts, we identify with actions. And then most importantly, we're going to actually take one class just on views. So in August, we're going to be looking at views because it's such a rich arena of how we get attached to that. I know I see that, especially in political views. I feel like that I have the right view. And then you might remember from Julian Beghini's video that I sent you last time, we also, another thing that we identify with are memories, desires, intentions, and sensation. Very much with memories. I have a sense of myself through my memories, and that's who I am. My desires, definitely, what I like and don't like. And also intentions. So this is what we went over last time in terms of trying to get a sense, beginning to sense of what the Buddha was talking about when he said this creation, this process of identification, this process of creating a self. And then this is all in the context of we're exploring a path to freedom rather than a philosophical view. Actually, I want to back up because I'm going to show you that there's a few different ways of understanding this process of identification or this process of creating a self. And I'm going to back up to the previous slide. The first one is how we commonly identify with certain aspects of experience. So that's the five khandhas, bodies, emotions, thoughts, actions, views, or from Beghini, memories, desires, intentions, sensations. But there's another way that we also have this sense of self that creates the suffering, and that's around having a feeling sense that there's a self at the center of experience. And you might remember the example of water, of H2O, that Julian Beghini gave us, that we have a hydrogen molecule, two oxygen molecules. And what we believe is that somehow there is some kind of essence. It'd be, if we believe in a self, it would be somehow believing there's some kind of essence underlying those three molecules coming together, but that H2O, that at the center of the H2O molecule is the essence of water, some kind of essence. So let me say that again, that's a bit convoluted. That we can take a molecule of water made of two hydrogen parts and an oxygen part, when we believe in a self, we believe that there's some essence at the center of it. But there actually isn't. It's a relationship between the two hydrogens and the oxygen. Or the example of a river. We can see a river like the Amazon River, and it's actually always changing. And of course, we use the word river, but it's something, the phenomena that's continually changing. And what we do is we can have a belief, this is what we do with ourselves, that there's some essence at the center of the activity of the river. This is what we're trying to undermine, is the sense of that there's some essence at the center of our experience. A lot of times, this essence is seen as a kind of identity that is constant, it's unchanging, it's continuous, and it's single, it has a quality of singularity. So what I mean by constant, it's the sense of here I am right now, and I'm the same person I was when I was 10 years old. So there's something constant there, which also implies that there's something unchanging, but also continuous. From 10 until the age I am now, same person. In a quality of singularity, that it's one person, it's not many people. For those of you who read that very long article by Jack Engler, there was a part of it which was just fascinating. He went over the different kinds of selves. He was talking about how we actually, we could say we have different configurations of ourselves. He talked about these in me-you patterns. Actually, he was referring to Harry Stack Sullivan at this point. And what was, again, it was this idea that there's some core at the base of all these different experiences, an identity residing deep inside of us. So not something that's relational, something that's private, innermost, a kind of innermost identity. It's kind of unknowable to others. And then we also spoke last time about, and this is something that we'll get to at the second part of our time together, is the actual practice, which is this last thing that you see there on this on the slide there, which is the practice of seeing this is not me, not mine, not I, in terms of thoughts and emotions. So when a thought comes up, being able to label thinking, planning, judging, it's just something that's arising and passing away. And then also getting the feeling sometimes in our experience of just walking or just breathing, just riding a bike, just eating, where there's a not so much of a sense of self anymore. Experience unfolding. This is the review from last time. And before I move further, I just want to take a minute or two here to give some space right now. So I'll leave a minute or two of silence. If you have any questions or comments in terms of this review or what we reviewed, please type them in the chat box and I'll comment on them or answer the questions. So let's take a few minutes just for that. So you'll have a minute or two of silence to type something in the chat box if you prefer to around this review. Okay, I'm going to take your silence as meaning that you completely understood everything we went over last time. And now we're going to switch into talking a little bit about some of the material I sent to you last week and go into detail of that. I sent you two sections. One was opening up to this sense of selflessness within our meditation, and then the section on the importance of a sense of self. Okay, just one comment here that I want to take some time with. Okay, so Alice says, a wonderful review. Philip Bromberg, also a contemporary psychoanalyst, also understands that there are constellated self states. Yeah, I just want to name, I think there's something really fascinating about this, that it, one way of tracking the unfolding of our experience is that in some ways there are different selves. Like who I am right now talking to you for this class is a different self than when I'm at home just hanging out with Robin, with my wife. And in some ways, you could say there's a multiple Brians or multiple selves that are there. And the way the illusion we get stuck in, and actually Harry Stack Sullivan calls this the mother of all illusions, is that there's this quality of singularity. And I think it can be really helpful to see these different selves as part of undermining our static sense of self. So yeah, thank you for that, Alice. I think it's a fascinating piece that hopefully we'll look into even more as we continue here. Okay, so I want to begin with the importance of having a sense of self. And I did this with the quote from Jack Engler. And I'm going to now switch over so you can see me. So I'm going to put up my cam. Hi. And that's the quote from Jack Engler. You have to be somebody before you can be nobody. And some of you might have hopefully read this article, the brief blog about Jack Engler. And I'm wondering if you were able to read the Jack Engler, if you can go to the My Mood and click on the green button that says yes, that would be great. And then if you weren't able to do that, if you can click on the no button, just so I can see if people were able to read that. And if you don't have the My Mood button up there, you can just put yes and yes or no in the chat box. Thanks, Randy. Yeah. Okay, good. Excellent. Wonderful. Thanks, Susan. Yeah, I actually found it a fascinating, thanks, Steve, view that we actually have to have a strong sense of self in order to move into getting a taste of this selfless quality of experience. And I think one way of seeing it is that a strong sense of self, or you could say strong ego strength or a strong ego, allows us to navigate the groundless quality of experience. This is really important. And I think it's usually too much to integrate all at once if we don't have the strong sense of self. And then Engler, you might remember, clarifies it. At first he was talking about it as a linear process, but then changes it and says, actually, this is something that we are continually developing in tandem. So develop in tandem on one side, a strong sense of self, of ego strength, which I'll go into what I mean by that. And on the other hand, developing, which we are continually exploring with this class, a sense of the selfless nature of experience, that there actually isn't anything fixed. And both are being developed kind of in tandem in a way. And then the other thing that I shared with you was around, the other article was around Anne Klein. And actually, just so we can change it, if you can raise your hand, so go to the My Mood and click the blue button if you are able to read a part of the Anne Klein or all of the Anne Klein section. So just click the blue button under My Mood to raise your hand if you're able to read the Anne Klein. Or click the red button, no, if you are not able to read the Anne Klein. And then for those of you who don't have the My Mood, you can just use the chat box. So were you able to read that? Wonderful. Okay, good. Some of you were able to, and some of you were not able to. Okay, Genevieve, Tata, you weren't able to. Steve, you weren't able to. Okay. Okay. There were some important things about the Anne Klein that I just want to go over, is that she was, so for those of you who remember, who read it, and those of you who did not, she was going over the creation or the complexity of this modern sense of self. And actually, Buddhism has never seen this kind of self before, so it's really a very different arena here. And what Anne Klein is talking about, she's taking a feminist perspective, so she's talking about the importance of creating a sense of self, especially for women, which I want to get back to because this is really important. But also goes into what is this modern sense of self, and she uses these words that it's based on choice, uniqueness, and specialness. So I want to go over this because this is really important. I want to point out that it didn't used to be like this. That if you think about it right now, people didn't have to make the kinds of choices and create the kind of identity that we need to right now. For example, if you were growing up in a tribe, the clothes you wear, the person that you were going to marry, the job that you were going to do, the food that you were going to eat, the religion that you were going to follow, were all determined for you. These were not things that you had to figure out. These were choices already made by the community and tribe that you were in. Rather, now what's happening is all of these are things that we have to choose. We have to choose our partner, clothes we're going to wear, the food we're going to eat, the job we're going to do, the religion we're going to follow. We're creating a sense of self that didn't need to be created in past times. And I want to share with you just two images that I think really exemplify this. So let me bring this up again for you. Just 1 second here. Okay, we have the review. So, a tribe from Kenya, if you can see this right now. I think a lot can be seen just within this image, right? Here are all these women standing together, and what they're wearing is almost identical. It's the same quality that they have. What they wear is determined by the tribe that they live in. What they believe, who they're going to marry, their religious view, determined by their community. They're not in the same position as, you could say, a person in the modern world, or especially in the Western world, that has to create a sense of self. Yet, a modern family here. If you look at all the details about, look at all of the people they're wearing different clothes. They have different hairstyles. Even with one of them, they have some emblem on their shirt that probably has some kind of meaning for them. So again, you might see in these two images, here we have a different creation of a self here that you could say comes from, especially from our past, and then the modern navigation that we're all involved in. As Barry Schwartz said, he did a video on, which I'm going to send all of you, around choice in particular. He says, we no longer inherit an identity. This is the image of inheriting identity. Rather, we mostly invent one. This is our world, whether you like it or not. And so a big part of this modern self is choice. Choosing, as I just pointed out. This is something that is taught to us from a very young age. You might remember from the Anne Klein reading, she referred to a story of a young Japanese girl going to, I think it was first grade or kindergarten. So she was, I think she was Japanese born, but coming from, who had come over to the U.S., with her family, and in her kindergarten or first grade, the teacher asked all the kids, what's your favorite color? Which you might remember is a really common question to ask. And this little girl didn't know, so she went home to her mother and asked, what's our favorite color in our family? And the mother didn't know how to figure out, so she had to call the teacher and ask, how do we figure out what our favorite color is for our family, for my little girl? From their culture, it didn't make sense to have a favorite color, to have these personal, unique preferences, whereas what we have is that's something that is built into us. And you might have felt the strain around this of the decisions that we have to make of what job we want to do, who to be partnered with, where to live, what to eat. There needs to be a kind of stability here for us to get a sense of the selfless nature of experience. And as a caveat, actually, more choice actually is correlated with suffering. And I'm going to share with you after this class, a TED video by Barry Schwartz, which goes into this aspect, the choice aspect of the modern sense of self. There are a lot of hooks within this. So I'm going to get into the particular suffering that comes from a modern sense of self, but I also want to go into the importance of this. Taking time to create a sense of self is very important. And when you read Anne Klein, I think what you get a sense of is, if you're not in the dominant group, which means if you're not white, if you're not male, if you're not heterosexual, so if you're not a straight white male, the creating a sense of self is extremely important, because the messages that one is given is usually comes from the dominant group. And a lot of times those are messages that don't serve us, or that can be incredibly oppressive. And I think this is one of the things that Anne Klein is getting at in what she's writing about, is how it's so important for women. She's talking about women in particular, but it could be any non-dominant group, to create a sense of self that comes from a different place. Because if not, then it's just simply following the dominant paradigm of patriarchy. And then I want to come back to the point that Alice pointed out too, that it can be even more complex when we feel like we have different selves that we have to present to the world that are radically different. And this can be very much the case if we come from a very different culture. Then a lot of times we have to navigate very different worlds. For example, someone who, a Chinese American or Japanese American, might have a very different self, speaking an entirely different language when they're with their family than when they're at work. And then with their friends that are from their community, a different self there than when they're at the grocery store. And it can even be even more subtle than that. I had a friend who was a Chinese-born American, and she said that she had to have one self for her family, who was Chinese-born, but a different self in the community that she was, which were American-born Chinese. And then she had to be, for example, at school, which was then a radically different self. In this context, she had to navigate this modern sense of self of having many different selves, and then creating these selves based around preference, around choice. It was so important, yet very complex. And then if we're part of any dominant group, whether it be being a male or being heterosexual, it could be being an American citizen. But again, it's really important to examine the kind of self that we're creating. Is it in a way that's oppressive to others? This is part of creating this strong sense of self. So one more part that I want to get into, which around this creating a sense of self, comes from getting a sense of our needs. And again, this is something that Carol Gilligan wrote about. She spoke about, and she was looking at moral development, moral maturity. She said that moral maturity was around the ability to balance the needs of oneself with the needs of others. And that this, what I want to point out is that this isn't entirely going to happen on a meditation cushion. We have to get really clear about our own needs so that we can meet the needs of others. And it's fascinating. Some of you might remember, who have studied Carol Gilligan, that she came out of examining the moral development models that were there before her, which were mainly around this man, Kohlberg, who was looking around moral development. But he only studied men. And as a result of that, she felt it skewed with the way moral development happens. And then brought into this more of a sense of moral development, specifically for women as well. Okay, and then one last thing, and then I'm going to ask for questions or comments, and then we're going to get into the kind of the modern kind of suffering that comes from that. But I just want to share with you a beautiful poem which I think exemplifies this development of a sense of self and how important it is. It comes from May Sarton. So I'm just going to go over this because I think it really embodies this in some way. So she begins, "Now I become myself. Taken time, many years and places. I've been dissolved and shaken, worn other people's faces. Run madly as if time were there, terribly old, crying a warning. Hurry, you'll be dead before what? Before you reach the morning or the end of the poem is clear? Or love safe in the walled city? Now to stand still, to be here. Feel my own weight and density. The black shadow on the paper is my hand. The shadow of a word as thought shapes the shaper, falls heavy on the page, is heard. All fuses now, falls into place, from wish to action, word to silence. My work, my love, my time, my face, gathered into one intense gesture of growing like a plant. Slowly as the ripening fruit, fertile, detached, and always spent. Falls but does not exhaust the roots. So all the poem is, can give, grows in me to become the song. Made so and rooted by love. Now there is time and time is young. Oh, in the single hour I live, all of myself, do not move. I the pursued who ran, who madly ran. Stand still, and stop the sun. I feel that there are some powerful phrases in this poem that speaks to the quality of becoming oneself, right? The beginning of the poem, now I become myself. And what it arises out of is seeing how she had been wearing other people's faces and that she had to move beyond that. And then what a description, right? To stand still, to be here, to feel her own density, her own weight. Such an important a phrase there. But I think this is an important process that we're involved in and we need to continue to be involved in. I want to stop here just to see, again, if there's any comments or any questions at this point about what I've gone over in terms of this modern sense of self. There's a difference between a tribal life like this compared to the modern life like this and the importance of becoming oneself. Yeah, so I'll just leave a few moments of silence now, a few minutes of silence, for you to write in the chat box if you want to share something or have any questions. Okay, so I might just speak to this first comment here. Yeah, Carol, I think that's a great question. You know, so the Buddha didn't, the Buddha didn't have to relinquish as much identity, as many selves as we do in this time. Or was he talking about relinquishing self? Just a few things about that. Yeah, I think a few ideas I have about that might help or might not. One is I appreciate just acknowledging that the sense of self that we're dealing with is different, or the creation of a sense of self was different than what the Buddha was dealing with. Yes, I think he had to still relinquish a sense of self, much more around that sense of self that Julian Beghini was talking about, around the H2O example, or around the example of the river. So I think when we navigate this this practice, we have to take into account the particular suffering that comes from the created identity that we have to undermine or see through that might not be spoken about in the early discourses. So yeah, I still think there's a relinquishment of a self, but it's a different flavor now in this modern time. Let me know if that fits or not, or I might have missed it a little bit, Carol, but thank you for asking that question. I don't think there was as many selves or the kind of complexity and creation, complexity in terms of the self. I don't think the Buddha had that as much. Yeah. Let me see what else is here. Stephen Patrick says, true self emerges not self. Self provides a platform for realization. I think to a certain extent, Steve, what you're talking about really could be true. I think there's different developmental models. I think there are some developmental models that really acknowledge that we create a stable sense of self, and then what emerges from that is the sense of not self or going beyond the self. And I think you're right, it does provide a platform for realization. I do appreciate the distinction that Jack Engler was making, though, is that it might not be a linear development, that there's this platform that the sense of self creates, or ego strength creates, is something that happens in tandem with the realization of not self. So I think it's an interesting thing to think about. Sometimes I don't know if any of you are familiar with Ken Wilber's developmental model, but I think it can be very helpful of explaining this kind of complexity. Brian Taylor points out that Sartan's poem ends with the present moment awareness, which can be an outcome of knowing one's own experience, as she does in the first part. Yes, I'm so excited that you're mentioning this. I think this is a really great insight to see that being present, this practice of present moment awareness, or the practice of mindfulness, not only helps us go beyond the self, but it helps stabilize a strong sense of self. It helps stabilize ego strength. So I'm glad you're pointing that out about the poem, as we can see mindfulness working in two different ways here. Going beyond the self and stabilizing the self. Brian Taylor, maybe this is another way of seeing the self. Maybe you can say more about that. I don't know what exactly you mean by that. Maybe I'm missing something there, but I'm intrigued by what you're maybe referring to in terms of the poem. So maybe you can type in something there as I continue here. Okay, Estelita. Estelita, you should let me know if I should call you by what name you'd like me to call you by. Okay, now I realize why some students stop insight meditation or lose interest in it, because they lack an integrated sense of self, which according to Engler makes insights more difficult, if not impossible. Yeah, I agree with this. I think this, again, is very important, is that some people can stop insight meditation, or they can get overwhelmed. This happens on longer retreats quite often, as people hit difficult material, there's not a strong sense of self, and it can shatter us in a way that's actually disintegrating rather than integrating. And I think this is something that needs to be acknowledged, especially for longer retreats. And I think you're right, Estelita, that we do, many people can stop insight meditation because it feels more disruptive rather than something that's integrating them. And I want to point out that this is important to know, that really, when we're really doing practice, it should feel disruptive at times. That's part of it, is it's not always going to feel great and integrative. And that's a good thing of what we're trying to do. So thanks for that insight there, Estelita. I think it's important to acknowledge that. Okay. Alice, I figure the Buddha consciously relinquished his Brahmanic identity, his family, social position, and was motivated to do so. Motivation arising out of a psychological agenda. I'm not sure this is relevant, but... Yeah, I think, wow, the way you word this, Alice, it makes other thoughts come up, which I find quite interesting, is I do think he had to consciously relinquish those identities, his Brahmanic identity and his family social position, which he probably, some of it he did just by becoming a monk, which in a sense is an outward expression of relinquishing those identities. It's leaving the homeless life. Yeah, and was motivated to do so out of a psychological agenda, that psychological agenda being, if this is what you mean, wanting inner freedom in some manner. So this is really important. And at the same time, what's so fascinating to me is he was still taking on or utilizing an identity, not believing in it, but utilizing it, utilizing the identity of being a monastic and playing that role in society, but not being hooked by it. So again, Alice, I think you're right. It was a conscious decision to relinquish those, and we see the outward expression of that through the taking of robes. Hey, back to Brian Taylor. Brian Taylor, what I meant was that a sense of self can be just present moment awareness of one's own experience in the unique moment. Yes, it can be. There can be a sense of self equated with the present moment experience, present moment awareness of what one is experiencing right now. And in this practice, I want to point out, and I think you're right, I think that's probably conveyed within this poem of Now I Become Myself. And I want to point out, that's one of the things that we really want to undermine. This is the essence of what we want to undermine. And in particular, the last class, which I'm very excited about, that we'll do in September, I want to do around just around the nature of awareness, because it can be such a gateway into this this sense of this bound, this sense of going beyond self. So, yeah, Brian, I think that's one way of defining the self, and that very fixed sense of self is what we want to undermine. That there's someone that's being aware of this unique moment right now. But thank you for pointing that out. I think that this seemed like it's in the poem. Dan, any more comments or questions? And if I answered your question or replied to your comment where it seems like I didn't understand you so well, please feel free to type something else in. So I'll just give another minute or two before we go on, but I'd love to hear your comments or questions. Is what brings this whole exploration to life is when all of you share. Okay, on to Judy Bray. Let me make sure I didn't skip anybody here. Okay, yeah. Okay, Judy says, I like the idea that this process is not linear. We are working at all these levels, spiritually and psychologically. As Ken Wilber hypothesized, we move into different levels. Once there is a knowing of a layer, then the next level can be explored. Yes, I agree. I also really appreciate that it's not a linear process, that we're working at all these levels, and that we can... at least if I can remember his model some, we kind of jump from level to level. Like I might have experiences of levels that are beyond where my development is, but then I reside in a lower level. But I keep on kind of fluidly moving back and forth even within a day until these levels or layers get stabilized. And I think you're right. Once there's a knowing or an embodiment of a layer, then the next level can be explored. And that's really what we're doing is stabilizing the level of, in this context, a sense of self or ego strength, and then going beyond that. And in many ways, the way we're going beyond that is, which we'll get to at the end here, is we go beyond it by getting these tastes through our meditation of going beyond the sense of self. Like in walking, there's just walking, and seeing, there's just seeing, which we'll get to, because these are the tastes that allow us to go to the next level using that frame of Ken Wilber's. Yeah, so thank you for that. Okay. I too, as Thalita says, I was touched by Engler's statement. First enlightenment is still enlightenment, and then much work remains. So first there's some kind of opening or awakening of some sort, but then much work needs to happen after that. And I think that also comes out of the quote that he had around Kapler-Roshi, is that we have some kind of awakening, but then we have to do the work stabilizing it. And there was a Korean Zen master, Chinul, who speaks about this very explicitly of tracing back the radiance, that one has a sense of getting a taste of awakening, and then it's cultivating the stabilization of that awakening, which I think fits into what we're talking about. Yeah, so thank you for that. I too was touched by that. Randy, yeah, it is such a paradox. We must know the self before we can let go of the self. Engler says, sense of self gives us an innermost identity which helps us shape our life. Yeah, I think it is a paradox how this works, that we need to have this stability in something that is false and illusory in order to see that it's an illusion. And there is something kind of strange about it, but it makes so much sense. I think in some ways it's the missing link in many ways, or let me rephrase that. It's something that I feel like us modern people that we really have to be aware of. And that's why I wanted to present all of this, because I think it's such an important piece of the puzzle and it can be missing. And then there can be a kind of spiritual bypassing that happens, or we neglect having a stable sense of self. Yeah, so thank you for that comment, Randy. Yeah, I think you're right, Aslita. The continuous training is necessary, and there can still be character flaws and personal conflict. And that mindfulness practice is helpful in uncovering that. And again, Aslita, I agree, this is really important. And in another article of Jack Engler, he really points out that sometimes we view awakening as the narcissistic ideal, which is something that we really have to acknowledge. If we're practicing to become the perfect person with no character flaws, with no imperfections, then that's just a setup. We're just following this narcissistic ideal, which is really about our wounding rather than anything about awakening. So thanks for that comment. Important. Okay, let's see. And then... uncovering technique, yes, mindfulness can be that way. An uncovering technique that really leads to freedom. So there is that personal aspect. Steve, in some sense, this sense of layers seems more just a sense of depth or deepening realization. The sense of linearity of self to non-self realization is merely academic. I agree. I think the linearity is probably more of an academic thing of us trying to struggle to understand maybe a mysterious unfolding. And maybe it is just deeper and deeper layers that we're going through. And so, yes, I think that any model has its limits. And I think it has the sense of when we use language, one aspect of what we're exploring is revealed. Dogen's and Master Togen talks about this. And when something is revealed, something else gets hidden or something else gets concealed. And this is just the process of using language. But thank you for mentioning that, Steve. I think you're right. There is something really academic about the linear approach. Deck, are not all these features a product of being human? Don't know exactly what you mean by the phrase "these features." What comes to mind are these features could be aspects of identification. Yeah, if I understand you correctly, all these features would be a product of being human, in particular being a modern human being, because these are choices we used to not have to make. I hope that answered it, or maybe I misunderstood you. Okay, I'm going to move on now, just because I want to now, after discussing all this with you, I want to talk a little bit about some of the flavors of, okay, good. Thanks, Jack, that I got it. Okay, good. That come from this modern sense of self, because I think it has particular flavors of suffering. One is what comes from this modern sense of self, and probably, hopefully all of us can relate to this, maybe not, is a sense of separateness. And Anne Klein, I think, does a beautiful job of also shedding light on this. pointing out that what's inherent in creating a modern sense of self is our uniqueness and specialness. We are trained to try to become unique and special, which again, I just want to come back to these images because I think images say so much, right? This image of these tribal people, they are not trying to look unique and special. They're trying to be a part of a group, and that's part of their identity is this group identity, which is not as emphasized, and I think there's something lost here. I'm not saying that we need to go back to this. I'm just saying that what arises from this now is a particular kind of suffering, because here in this picture, right, you can almost see the intention, the trying to become unique and special. And then what's the kind of suffering when that's an impulse, trying to create an identity that's unique and special, is a sense of separation. One of the main things that comes to me when I meet with people and I can see myself is one of a big sense of suffering, which is a big shadow that all of us carry, is wanting to be included or a sense of inclusion. Because if I have to be unique and special, then a lot of times it makes me feel like I'm not included. So there's this disjunct here in that I don't belong. So there can be a lot of issues around belonging and inclusion that arise in this modern life of ours. And not belonging to the people around us, but also, especially now in this modern world, not belonging to the earth that we come from. And so there's this wound around this separateness. As John O'Donohue says, he says, actually our bodies know that they belong. It is our minds that make our lives feel so homeless. He continues, our modern hunger to belong is particularly intense. An increasing majority of people feel no belonging. We have fallen out of rhythm with life. The art of belonging is the recovery of the wisdom of rhythm. We're separate from each other, from the earth, and the rhythms of life, at least according to John O'Donohue, which gives this sense of separation. And this is why I think this can be so helpful practicing outdoors, because it can bring back this sense of belonging. I don't know if anybody here is going to be doing my mindful hike this Sunday, but I think that's the importance of practicing outside is healing some of this wound so that we can go beyond a separate sense of self. So I think that's a big one that comes from this modern sense of self. Think before I go further than this. Denise, he said, it is our minds that make our lives so homeless. Yeah, our minds, or the thought process that we get caught in. And I think there's something true about it. When I sense into the body, there's a lot of times a sense of belonging. I think that's the powerful thing of mindfulness of the body. Okay. That's all I want to say about the modern. Oh, and then one other piece around the suffering that arises around a modern sense of self, and that's around choice. And I'm going to send you this video, which will explain this in detail, is that when I have more choice, it feels like I suffer more. And they've done studies about this. If you give people lots of choices when they pick something, they have much more of a tendency to feel like they didn't make the best of choices. Where if you only give someone two or three choices, there can be much more of a sense of settledness around that. But just, I mean, go to a grocery store, right? It's amazing how many choices that you have around tomato sauce. It's crazy and not helpful. And yet we've equated choice with freedom. And hopefully by now, maybe like me, maybe you're starting to see that maybe that's not the case. Again, just I want to briefly stop again to see if there's any questions or comments, and then we'll move on to part two here. Thanks, Bradley. Yeah, I think there is something exciting about it, and I just want to read Bradley's comment here. Call me parochial, but the parallels between cultivating a sense of self and non-self simultaneously is completely new and stimulating to me. Thanks to all of you for the dialogue. Yeah, I agree. Thank you to all of you for this. This is really I find it fascinating. And again, Jack Engler's written quite a bit about this, which I find helpful, his exploration of this. Steve, to differentiate does not necessarily lead to suffering. Yeah, and I want to come back to the statement because I think there's something juicy about that. Placing greater value or attachment to the distinction may lead to suffering. Yeah, I think you really hit it on the mark. Is right, we need to differentiate from each other or have a sense of differentiate. You could even say children from their mother, from their parents. The whole process of I'm hearing you use the word differentiation in terms of developmental, like self-development, the way we think about it in terms of psychology. Yeah, it does not necessarily lead to suffering, and I'd even add to that, not only does it not necessarily lead to it, but to have less suffering, we need to differentiate. And I think you hit the money on the mark. We place greater value or attachment to those distinctions, and that's what makes the suffering, is when I see it as something solid and real and static, this differentiated self, I suffer. Yeah, so I think thanks for that comment. I think that's really adds some clarity to our discussion here. Okay. Anything else? Okay, so onward. I gave you two early discourses to read. Again, I want to make sure to expose you to some of the early discourses. So I'm going to bring those up, and maybe I'll bring up the image of myself again. And so if you have those, that would be great if you can pull them out. If you don't, that's okay too. I want to review those a little bit with you. Hi. Okay, let me just see if there's one other comment that I want to continue. Let's see. Okay, good. Okay, so I gave you two of the early discourses. One was the Subha Sutta, I think it's the Sabha Sutta, the All. And I'm just going to read it because it's so short, because I really think it speaks to our practice. Now I want to get into our practice a little bit. Buddha says, "Monks, I will teach you the All. Listen and pay close attention. I will speak." "As you say, Lord," the monks responded. Blessed one said, "What is the all? What is everything?" is basically saying. What's the entirety of our experience? "Simply the eye and forms, ear and sounds, nose and aromas, tongue and flavors, body and tactile sensations, the intellect and ideas. This, monks, I call the all or everything. Anyone who would say, repudiating this all, I will describe another, questioned on what exactly might be the grounds for his or her statement, would be unable to explain, and furthermore, would be put to grief. Why? Because it lies beyond the range of this everything." And then I just want to read one piece of the Bahia Sutta that I sent you, and that's the instructions they gave to Bahia. If I can find it here. Well, maybe I don't have it. Ooh. Oh, here we go. "During Bahia, you should train yourself thus, and the seen will be merely what is seen, and the heard what is merely heard, and the sensed will be merely what is sensed, and the cognized what is cognized. In this way, you should train yourself, Bahia." So here we have practice instructions, which I want to come back to. "When Bahia for you in the seen is merely what is seen, and the heard what is heard, and the sensed what is sensed, and the cognized what is merely cognized. Then Bahia, you will not be with that. When Bahia, you are not with that, then Bahia, you will not be in that. When Bahia, you are not in that, then Bahia, you will be neither here, nor there, nor beyond, nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering." Okay, I'm giving you two different quotes here that I want us to explore a little bit. I want to go back first to the Sabha Sutta, to the all. Here the Buddha is saying that The Buddha, everything that we experience is just eye and forms, ear and sounds, nose and aromas, tongue and flavors, body and tactile sensations, the intellect and ideas. I'm wondering if someone would be willing just to put this in your own words, to type in the chat box. What does this mean? What is the Buddha trying to say with this about explaining everything being just this? What's the usefulness of this? Or can you put it in your own words in some way? It doesn't have to be anything sophisticated. Yeah, and then just share that in the chat box. Okay, Steve, yeah, to be in the moment with, I'm neither that or not that. I am free from that. Yeah, so this is, I appreciate your wording. So again, to be in the moment with, I am neither that nor not that. I am free from that. But I think the Buddha is, actually, Steve, your comment fits with more the Bahiya Sutta. Maybe we'll jump to that because I think that fits quite well. So maybe we'll come back to the all, just because I think your wording fits with his instructions to Bahiya. So what is he pointing out to Bahiya? He's pointing out, and I think, Steve, your comment speaks to this, is how we identify with certain aspects of experience. Who is seeing? I am the one who is seeing. Who is hearing? I am the one who is hearing. And then I create stories around that seeing or hearing. Oh, I see someone have some kind of reaction to me. Oh, then I create a story around it. That story, we could say, is a sense of self. And again, we're going to get to this in August around views, how a sense of self is not just how I identify with this body, it's about the world I create. So this is going to be a really important exploration that we do. And there's freedom when I'm neither that, it's just seeing unfolding or hearing unfolding. Experience unfolding and not positing a self on that. So it's the simplicity of bare seeing or bare hearing without the complications. Yeah, so thank you for that. Any other way of putting your own words, either the all per sutta or the Bahiya Sutta that I explained, or a question? Alice, awareness of what is present to the senses and the mind allows one to notice without reactivity. This is the practice of meditation. Yes. Okay, so again, this is really great. It's seeing things for what they are, if I understand you correctly, Alice. It's one seeing the senses and the mind, how the thinking is part of the senses here, and awareness of what is present to the senses or the mind. This is what we're doing without reactivity, yeah. And then when reactivity arises, it's seen that it's just happening in one of the sense gates, right? If it's a thought, it's just that which is cognized. It's an emotion. It's that which is in the quality of feeling the body. This is everything, whereas we think it's bigger than it is rather than these component parts of the all. Is this making sense? So I want to go over this a little bit, and I appreciate your comments, so please keep them coming. With the all, it reminds me that experience is only these component parts, these six component parts of the six sense gates. When I start to think it's more than that, that's when I get into trouble in some way. And then if there's something that arises in my life that's difficult, can be so helpful just to notice when, for example, I get angry. Oh, interesting, anger. Okay, so then we have this component part of, oh, there's a sensation of it. I feel it in that sense gate. In terms of what's cognized, you can even bring the heart into that. Oh, it has the flavor of anger. It's just these components coming together. Oh, and then there's the meaning that this person did this to me. When I see the component parts, I can start to be with it rather than to be entangled with it. Okay, Stelita. see the thing as it is and not with comments or thoughts, recognizing without colored glasses. Yes. Yeah. To see things as they are without getting hooked by the description or the thoughts about it, and when the thoughts arise about it, to see that it's just a thought. And you say recognizing without colored glasses. I would change that actually just a little bit. It's actually recognizing the colored glasses. I think what we're going to start to see is that there's always colored glasses on, and what I can do is start to see them at play, that they're working right now. I don't know if we can always completely take them off, but we can see the activity of them. Also, if you have any disputes about this or things that don't work, maybe this is not effective, this language that we find the Buddha talking about everything about when he's talking about the all, or the instructions of the Bahia, maybe you find it problematic or not helpful. That's also something really that we can talk about as well. So a few more minutes for just comments, and then one last piece here. Okay. Bradley. Okay, so Bradley. So my heart practice is love, compassion, forgiveness, part of the all or not? Yeah, most definitely part of the all, but it's at least in this practice of insight. So I want to say that's different than heart practices, and heart practices also lead to liberation as well. But we can see that compassion is really, a lot of times, it's a thought and an emotion, which we can feel in our bodies in terms of sensation. And those coming together have the particular flavor of compassion or the particular flavor of forgiveness or love. But they all can be situated in these six senses, you could say. These are just seeing I got distracted. It fits into this category of the six senses as a way of breaking down, seeing the component parts. But yeah, it definitely fits into the all. Carol, I found the Saba quote does not fare well with folks who claim to have extraterrestrial experiences. Yet it seems that everything they experience falls within the Buddha's all. I agree. I mean, it's an interesting comment by the Buddha. He's really boiling it down to these six things, and he's not talking about the extrasensory world. He's saying that it all fits within these six things. I think the one caveat, though, is I think the way the Buddha understood psychic powers, and maybe, who knows if he completely believed in them or not, is that they would still be within the six senses. So, for example, when he talks about the divine eye, it's still within the sense gate of the eye. It's just that the eye, the organ, when I say the eye, the visual eye, it's just seen at large distances, so it's still within the six senses. Or one who can hear at large distances, which would be a psychic power in the early discourses, would still be part of the six senses. So it's still open to debate. So it fits within the all because of the way they describe psychic powers is situated within the six senses. They don't talk about extrasensory. They just talk about, you could say, sensory in the terms of being psychic or special. Kempton, the all was unclear for me. Does it simply mean experience? Yes, I think that's the simple way of doing it. It was just seeing what experience is. He's basically defining what experience is through the six senses. So actually, I'm glad you're asking the question because it's clarifying it. The all is another word for what experience is. Ryan. Okay, when the scene heard, sense, cognize is merely what is seen, heard, sense, cognize, and not how we react to the same, then there is no separation between me and that. We are not with that and that. Between me and that. We are not with that and that, or between self and that, as the sutta says. Yeah, I think that's another great way of seeing it, is a lack of separation, a lack of duality, which again, non-duality is something that I really want to explore with you around the nature of awareness with this last class in September, because the non-dual is so important, and that language is not used in the early discourses, but I feel it fits in the early discourses, the non-dual experience or the non-dual understanding of a collapsing between the subject and the object. Okay. So maybe I will go on from here. Thank you for your comments. These are really great. So the last piece is, I want to check in. This is one of the things I asked you to do, was to reflect before this class about your practice. This is really what this is about, is what you're exploring in your practice and what you're discovering. And I'd love to hear about any experiences that you've had around this not-self, in terms of your meditation or in terms of your daily practice. What have you started to see? What have you started to realize? Alice has a question here or a comment. The heart practices come from having made a moral choice. I guess this belongs to the category of intellect and ideas. Yes, it would. Yeah, that would go into the category of intellect ideas. Yes, so now the practice. What have you been discovering? What have you noticing? Questions or confusions that are arising? Anything around the practice now? Okay, so Steve, there appears to be a very descriptive quality or analytical quality to this practice, which allows a cessation of recognition, a cessation or recognition of attachment. Interesting. Yeah, okay, so that through analyzing or really seeing, having that quality, descriptive quality, it allows a stopping of being attached to the self or being stuck in the self. Nice. Good, thank you for sharing that. And I want to point out, just when I hear this, because I think you're right, kind of when we analyze what's going on, seeing that there's not me, not mine, I think this is maybe what you're referring to, Steve, it can help get more of a self of not self, of like just walking, happening, rather than there needing to be a subject there. Another gateway, which is really key for our practice, is impermanence. Really, like, much of our practice is about seeing impermanence, and when impermanence is seen very, very deeply, it disrupts any kind of solid sense of self, because then there's simply the experience of flow, of unfolding of experience, rather than something solid underneath it. Needs more fluidity in life, less stickiness when practicing this not me, especially in difficult situations. Great. Okay, good. Yeah, more fluidity. What a wonderful thing. And I appreciate what you're pointing out, Denise, is also that this is connected with your freedom, really pointing out that, yeah, that as the word you used, less stickiness in difficult situations when there's not an identification. Oh, interesting. This is what the mind does. This is what this conditioning does in this situation. What a fascinating thing. Let's see how to navigate it. Yeah. Back. The language of disidentifying, sadness is happening, for example, has been very helpful for me. Wonderful. Yeah. It is a kind of language you're using, where what's implied in the language is disidentifying, as sadness is happening or anger is happening. Noticing the unfolding of experience without a self there. Okay. Yeah, any other comments or questions about the practice, and then a few moments with that, and then we'll take a step further of some more things that we can explore or practice with. Hilarious. I love it at Salito. When you got a bad haircut, I say, I am not this. Nice. great insight. I love that. Okay, Randy, impermanence helps me let go and see in moments there is nothing to hold on to. Thank you. And actually, I want to come back to this because this is one of the practices that I want to see if we can get a sense of in our meditation. Yeah, because this is really what we're going for, is seeing when we really get a sense of impermanence, we notice there's nothing to hold on to. And this is really what we're going to, especially a sense of self. And I want to talk about different ways of getting a taste of this impermanence in the context of what we're exploring, but I want to come back to that just to see if there's any more comments. Maybe I should check this. I need to check one more thing. Kempton asks, or Kempton comments, maybe you could reflect a bit on the Brahma Viharas and the sense of self. Yeah, a few things about that. I think the Brahma Viharas are quite fascinating within the context of what we're talking about, at least for me. One of the things I've noticed around the practice of the Brahma Viharas is actually strengthening a stable sense of self, namely a lovable self. I have found the practice of loving kindness so helpful for ego strength and for creating a stable sense of self that works for me. One is a sense of self that I love or that I can be friendly to. So I think it's incredibly important for the sense of self. And then it also allows me to sense into other important qualities so I can have a stable sense of self. Another one is mudita, sympathetic joy, which I find really helpful. Taking the joy in others, I need to be stable in my own contentment in order to be able to appreciate the joy of others without becoming envious. A lot of times, I get lost in envy because there's a small sense of self, a sense of not enough, or I'm no good, or I always need more, which is a kind of self which is not so helpful. So when I practice mudita, it helps stabilize this, for me, a sense of contentment of, because then I can enjoy your joy. Those are just two examples. In terms of the not-self spectrum, I also think the Brahma Viharas can be incredibly powerful. I think a lot of times, like when I was doing the month-long on loving-kindness, at times there would be a feeling, a couple different feelings that I think would have flavors of not-self. One was the feeling that it wasn't me that was generating kindness, it was the feeling of kindness kind of moving through me or moving through experience, and there was just this conduit, this container that I was calling the self. So it could really disrupt. I found that the practice of loving kindness disrupted this sense of self in that way. The other way I find that it can disrupt this sense of self is, especially with compassion, just connection, just as I suffer, other people suffer. And I can understand your suffering because I suffer, and it can help break down the boundaries of separateness. So I think these are just a few different flavors of not self that can arise from the Brahma Viharas. I think there are more. And also how it can, at the same time, strengthen a stable sense of self. Interesting. I tend to get a sense of merging with a lack of solidity in my practice. Okay, Steve, I don't know if I understand you correctly. I might change the word merging to a sense of connection or intimacy. The reason I avoid merging is just from psychological terms. When you think of early children, early development, when the child is merged with their mother and has no differentiation. So if I put in the word maybe a sense of connection or intimacy, spiritual intimacy, when there's a lack of solidity in my practice, I think that makes so much sense. So thank you for that. Yeah. Judy Bray, I find no self-practice produces more openness and inclusion. Yeah, this is what we're going for. This is not just some kind of intellectual thing. We're trying to become intimate with reality in some way. And I think the words you use speak to that openness and inclusion. Thank you for that, Judy. Yes. Oh, the merging is, Steve clarifies, the merging is not the same as a lack of awareness, but just a sense of fluidity. Okay, yeah, great, sense of fluidity. That makes sense to me now. Thank you for that clarification. Susan Pardee, how do you react to a group discussion on various news happenings or just everyday life happenings and you are silent, trying to relate all of the sensory experiences without a reaction? Okay, let me see. How do you react to a group discussion on various news happenings or just everyday life happenings, and you are silent, trying to relate to all of the sensory experiences without a reaction. Okay, Susan, I might not completely understand your question, but I'll give it a try. How I react or relate to like a group discussion on a news event is, I guess it's a process for me in the sense of I simply notice what arises around a news event. It could be what's going on in Iraq now. Let's take that or something like that. And there's an emotional reaction, and I'm in a discussion with people. In some ways, I'm just noticing what's there. There might be anger or confusion or sadness. And part of the practice is just to simply be with those and all their variety. This is going to tie into the practice, the instructions a little bit later. And then it's sharing that. So I'm relating to the sensory experience, and then I might share that without a reaction. The way I'm without a reaction is that what I'm cultivating is that whatever I feel around that news item, what's going on in Iraq, is okay. So it's the quality of acceptance that helps cut down getting lost in reactivity. Is that fitting? Does that fit what you're asking or not? Maybe you can type in something, let me know if I'm on the line, or maybe you want to clarify a bit. Maybe as Susan Pardee is writing there, I might take us to the next step. Susan, did that fit at all, or maybe I'm off, or any comments there on what I just shared? Totally, yes. Usually the group will want an answer, and feelings are not what they want to hear. Ain't that the truth? I think especially with things that are more emotionally charged, sometimes people are going for an answer and not acknowledging feelings. That's what I call a drag. I hear you. And what a challenging thing to navigate. How to kind of, it's almost like, can you honor people who want answers and to open up a space where more can be included in the conversation? I'm glad you're naming it. It is such a tough dynamic. I want to move on just a little bit. We just have a few minutes left, a little bit of around impermanence. And I want to bring it back to one of the things I talked about, which is another way of framing. I want to give two different frames here. One is what I talked about in terms of Harry Stack Sullivan, which also the monk under talked about, which is the sense of a self arising in past. So this is different language than we're using. But remember, we're not going for a coherent philosophical frame. We're going for what's useful for a practice. Can you notice throughout the day the different selves that arise and pass away? So right now, I have the teaching self right now that is arising right now, and I'm teaching you. When I turn this off, I have to clean the house. There will be the cleaning self that arises, and then that will pass away. We'll be seeing a client self that arises and passes away. Can you see the many selves that arise and pass away? So, actually, I should be a little bit more specific. I'll go into the way the Zen master I practice with. He said that what would happen in our life is that a self would arise, and I'm using a little bit different language here. I'm speaking a little more poetically here. Like the teaching self is right here now. And then I get involved in an activity, and then I lose a sense of self, and then another self arises that might be a different self. The reason I'm using this language is, one is you can see the different kinds of identities that come up during the day, that come up when you speak to people, different people. And it can give you a sense of fluidity, a sense of not self, that there's nothing static there. It can give a sense of impermanence. So that's one thing that I want you to explore, is maybe using the frame of many selves as a way of undermining that there's just undermining the sense of singularity, that there's just one of me. The other thing that I want to invite you to explore is just impermanence, very simply, the sound of my voice coming and going, the abdomen rising and falling, or the chest cavity rising and falling as I breathe in and out. How a thought comes and goes, how emotions arise and pass away. The more the mind experiences that again and again and again, I swear you'll get the sense of the undermining of any fixed quality within your experience and more fluidity. Any questions about these two, adding these two things, or anything you want to comment on what you want to add for the practice? Just a way of comments on that or questions? A way of finishing up here. Also, if you haven't typed something in, you might just want to type something in about that or anything else. Okay. So this will be two things to get a sense of. I might send you something to read a little bit about this to give more of it. Okay, Genevieve, not everybody, let's see. Okay, Genevieve says, I appreciate the idea not going for a coherent philosophical model. Yes, we're not going for that. What works for our practice being more important? Yes, I totally agree. So use whatever frame, and I'd love to hear the frame that you use. The language that you use would be great. So that might be something we can explore next time. I want to recap a little bit. Actually, not recap, but just to talk about what's coming next. Estelita, yes, I think impermanence is a great technique to practice myself. I might be able to find a passage that I can send you about this, the unfolding of how impermanence leads to not self. Actually, Jack Engler writes something about it, which is really good. It's a little, maybe too descriptive, but it can be very helpful. So I might send you that. I'm going to be sending you the video by Barry Schwartz around choice. Those are the two things, and I'm going to be sending those immediately. To remind you, in July, we're going to have a guest speaker, William Edelglass, and a couple weeks before that, I'll send you some readings around that, and then we're going to tie this into a practice that we're going to get from Stephen Batchelor's translation of Nagarjuna. I mean, he gives us a beautiful poetic description of it, which can be used as a way of practice, so... I will send that all to you soon. I'll send the video and the impermanence thing soon, and then the stuff on Nagarjuna in a few weeks. Okay, any closing comments or anything I'm forgetting at this point? Please type in anything if I'm forgetting anything or last comments. Okay, so a few things. Thank you, everyone. What I really appreciate is the dialogue that we have. I get so much from your comments, and your willingness to explore this with me, I think, is so helpful. It makes it lively and exciting. So I look forward to our next exploration that we'll have with William, and he's much better at the whole guiding discussion than me, so I think it will be quite lively. And we'll continue with this whole exploration. And thank you all for all you thank yous, for all your thank yous. And I so look forward to our next class in July. And you'll be getting an email from me shortly with more stuff. Okay. Take care, everyone. I'm going to sign off now. And you have a wonderful day. Okay. Goodbye.